Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, security in a post-Belgium terrorist attack world. We go behind the front lines of the fight for Mosul, Iraq. We hear about two possibly life-saving devices being developed for patients.
They can monitor their own health, and they can also get the results very quickly to make some decisions on their own health.
And a pioneer of hip-hop lyricist, Fife Dawg, has died. It's right here on The Voice of America. Europe and many nations around the world are reflecting on their security in light of Tuesday's series of terrorist attacks in Belgium that left at least 31 people dead and 300 others wounded. We asked General Michael V. Hayden, retired U.S. Air Force four-star general and former director of the Central Intelligence and the National Security Agency, his reaction to the bombings.
This was sadly expected, almost inevitable. And I realize that's a pretty dramatic word. But when you look at what has happened, the target country, part of an arc that we could see. The target itself in terms of the soft targets, the transportation targets, the maximum civilian casualties, something we could see. The level of sophistication, kind of continuing on that same arc we've seen ISIS as it, so to speak, ups its game. And I think the only thing that changed the arc that we all saw coming was perhaps the tempo, which was probably sped up by the arrest of one of the terrorists last week. And my sense was they feared what he would tell the police. And so this was a use it or lose it kind of situation with regard to the plot. But again, the great sadness is this is not surprising. And which then suggests it's certainly not the last either.
You can hear more of his remarks this Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA with host Carol Castiel right here on The Voice of America. Well, joining us now here in the studio is national security correspondent Jeff Seldom. Welcome, Jeff.
Good to be here.
Thank you. You were on the panel, the exclusive panel, speaking with Mr. Hayden. And what did you walk away with from that conversation?
Well, there were a number of things to walk away with. First, as you just heard him say, the inevitability of this type of terror strike. It's something we've heard now from him, from lots of other current officials, counterterrorism intelligence officials, former officials, that there's going to be more attacks. There's a deep concern about just how deeply rooted the Islamic State has become in Europe, how they're treating Europe not so much as just a place to carry out terror attacks, but as part of their ever-expanding battlefield as they try to expand their caliphate. And they're looking at it, according to some experts, as an expeditionary force. They're jihadists who are in Europe. So that's one thing. But also the difficulty that Europe has and that the world is going to have in terms of combating and cracking down on the terrorists, that it is not an easy job because it is deeply rooted. It takes a lot of resources. And one of the things that the general, the former CIA director and NSA director said was, look, the U.S. has a lot of resources and has a lot of expertise. And while there are some very good security services in Europe, none of them are able to match what the U.S. is able to do, certainly not the Belgians.
Well, one of the issues under consideration in the aftermath of this tragedy in Brussels is intelligence sharing.
That's been an ongoing concern, and that's been something that Europe itself has been working on. It's admitted that it's been a deficiency, and it was evidence after the Paris attacks, the way the suspect who's now in custody, Absalom, was able to slip through various checkpoints with police and other officials as he left Paris and made his way back to Belgium where he was hiding out. Europol, the European police agency, has stood up a new counterterrorism center, the European Counterterrorism Center, at the start of the year. But the challenges that effort is facing, enormous. You have cultural challenges just because of the numerous agencies from different countries that now are starting to look at this as a focal point and need to cooperate. There's also the need to trust each other. And one of the things General Hayden said in the interview was that in some cases, European countries are more comfortable sharing intelligence information with the U.S. than they are with each other. That level of trust has to be developed. And there's also an IT challenge. There's a need to get everybody working on the same systems and the same databases so that information can be easily shared and then accessed when needed. And that's something that's going to take some time.
Are experts calling for severely beefing up the international security web?
Well, they are saying more needs to be done. And there have been a number of people, some U.S. officials even, who have come out, not giving their names, but criticizing the efforts by Belgium to crack down on the jihadist network. And remember, Belgium, when it comes to European countries and foreign fighters that have gone to Iraq and Syria, many of them to fight with Islamic State, per capita, Belgium has the highest number. And the neighborhood that's been the focus of many of their manhunts of late, Molenbeek, has a very high concentration of these radicals. But it's also something that Belgium simply doesn't have the same resources. It's not as big a country as France, Britain, not as big as the U.S. So there are resource problems as well. But one thing that's also been consistent among all the officials, the intelligence officials, counterterrorism officials, current and former that I've talked to, is that you can do as many raids as you want. You can put out as many task force, as many police, as many troops into these cities as you want. It is not going to take care of the problem because it is that deeply rooted. It's not just that there are jihadist cells and networks that are operational, constantly looking for targets. There's a problem in terms of the permissive atmosphere, the receptive atmosphere that's been created over decades in some of these neighborhoods in Europe, dealing with getting back to a number of social issues, how these immigrant populations have been accepted into the community. It's a deep-seated problem, but it makes many of these areas receptive to the jihadist message. And so until you take care of that problem, many of them say, you can run as many manhunts, as many raids, as many crackdowns as you want. There will be more.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. And we are joined now by our social media reporter, Andrew Palcheski. Say, Andrew, what have you been finding on the web about this story?
Well, as the story has progressed in the days after the attacks, there's a lot of blame on social media for the Belgian authorities, saying that they expected an attack like this and didn't do enough to stop it. There's a lot of anger on social media being expressed. And we're also seeing now, sadly, some of the names of the victims coming out, and we're learning a little more about them. For example, we know that a university student was killed in the metro bombing, that a mother of 3-year-old twins was one of the victims at the airport. So those stories are starting to come out, and we're putting faces and names with these numbers that we're hearing.
It really brings it home, doesn't it, when you can see these people? They're not just a number like we usually are on these kinds of stories.
Absolutely. It's really heartbreaking to think that this was someone's mother, this was someone's son, and social media absolutely expressing that, their condolences, sharing these names. Also on social media, I saw a story about a young man who was a victim in the Boston Marathon bombing here in the U.S. and was actually in the Brussels airport when that attack happened. So he's had two instances of terrorism strike his life. So you learn about stories like that. You learn also about people like basketball star Dikembe Mutombo was in the airport during the attack. He was unharmed, fortunately. But you learn about these different things through social media. You find out these different stories.
Well, just a quick question here. I'm really interested in how the government uses social media in situations like this. Have you seen some tweets or some Facebook things from the government?
Yes, we've seen the Belgian prime minister come out and say that he wanted people to use social media to get in touch with family members, for instance, not to tax the cell phone lines, which some of them were down, some of them were just overburdened and weren't able to handle that many calls after the attacks. So that was a unique way of using social media to get a word out into a mass audience and say, actually use these tools, because they are tools, to help communicate.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Andrew, as always.
Thank you very much.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Earth's auroras, Borealis in the northern polar region and Australis in the south, are among the most beautiful and haunting light displays in nature. Now, for the first time, scientists have been able to study Jupiter's auroras in X-ray wavelengths thanks to NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. Auroras, both on Earth and on Jupiter, are triggered by high-charged solar particles blasting their way through the solar system and into the magnetic fields of the planets. But scientists have found that Jupiter's aurora, generated by a giant interplanetary coronal mass ejection, happened to be 8 times brighter and have hundreds times the energy than Earth's aurora. The study of Jupiter's aurora comes just months before NASA's Juno spacecraft is set to arrive at the planet. The Juno mission will study Jupiter's makeup, gravity field, magnetic field, or magnetosphere, and its relationship with the solar wind. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Iraqi forces backed by Kurdish Peshmerga fighters have launched what they describe as the first step to take the Islamic State militant group's stronghold city of Mosul. Today, forces from two Iraqi brigades from Iraq's U.S.-trained 15th Division began the fight against six IS-held villages southeast of Mosul. Correspondent Sharon Bain is on the outskirts of Mosul with the U.S.-backed forces, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, welcome, Sharon.
Hi, how are you? I was out on the front line. There is a combination of Peshmerga and Iraqi forces. They were flying both flags at the front line where I was. It was actually, while I was there, we could see a coalition airstrike hit one of the villages. We could feel some of the reverberation. What was happening was that the Islamic State in the villages had taken out tires and were burning tires to create a kind of black smoke, so that it would be hard for the aircraft to hit their target.
Are there people fleeing the area?
No, most of the civilians apparently had already fled the villages several days ago. The only thing that was left were the Islamic State. It was several kilometers away. We had to look through binoculars in order to be able to see the actual villages. The Peshmerga forces had stopped at what they considered their territorial front line. They had decided not to go and to the actual combat with the Iraqi forces because they feel that that is Sunni territory, Sunni Arab territory, and not theirs. So they're holding their front line. What they were telling me, though, was that nobody knew what would happen at night. Right now, the Iraqi forces were still trying to hold these villages, but it was unknown whether ISIS or Daesh, as it's called here, whether they would turn around and try to attack at night.
Are the forces you are with confident that they will win this fight in the end?
The forces I'm with, yes, they are confident that they will win the fight in the end, you know, but they are also the commander, the general that I spoke to, said that this is a very pivotal moment. He said it really matters as to whether the Iraqi forces can actually take and hold these villages. He said this will be the first step, so it's very, very important to see how they do. If he feels that if they succeed in this first step, then they can go the next one and the next one. He says if they fail in this step, then that's going to be a big setback. I think in the end, they all feel that in the end, you know, ISIS will lose. But there's a lot of caution, especially the Kurdish commanders are cautioning that it will be a long and extremely hard fight, and that Mosul is not going to be easy to take, and nor is it going to be easy to hold.
What are the conditions like for the troops, and for you, that matter, where you are?
Well, when I drove down to the front line, the troops, you know, some of them were sleeping on the flatbed of the vehicles. So I was with the Kurdish Peshmerga, which are there in combination with the Iraqi forces. So we had just gone to the front line. They basically were looking a little, I'm not going to say tense, but I think it sort of there was a lot of expectation. They just wanted to see what was going to happen next. So what the Iraqis there told me, was that they had created like a pincer movement. There were several 2,000 forces that had come from the left, 2,000 from the right.
I'm losing you, Sharon, so I'll just say thank you, Sharon, and be safe.
All right, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Coming up on International Edition, a possible medical device of the future, and we look at the contribution of a pioneer of hip-hop. It can be a matter of life or death, waiting for test results from a laboratory concerning a serious health problem. But two small medical devices now in development can quickly diagnose some conditions, including the possibility of a heart attack. Reporter Deborah Block is following this story and joins us on the line. Welcome, Deborah.
Thanks very much, Susan.
So, what can you tell us about the first device?
Well, the first device has a great name. First of all, it's called a tricorder. That was the same name as the fictional medical scanner that was used in the Star Trek TV series.
Yeah, Dr. McCoy had one.
Right. What's that?
Dr. McCoy had one.
That's right, Dr. McCoy. And, I mean, what was great about that, as I always said, I wish I had one of these now, is that little thing would go over the body, and they might be in terrible pain, and all of a sudden they would just jump off the table and be fine. Well, this group that's come up with this real-world tricorder can diagnose some diseases, can't go as far as the Star Trek one, but this one will be able to test blood, urine, and saliva samples. There's a small chip in this handheld device that contains a complex liquid network that can test those fluids. And then those diagnostic results are actually forwarded to a smartphone app. And the inventor of this tricorder, who is a professor of biomedical engineering at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C., says the goal of this device is potentially to put it in a to get the results in a physician's office or even in your own home or both or a hospital. And what this means is that you can get these results within hours, if not minutes. And as you mentioned, the rapid response could alert someone of an impending heart attack or perhaps diagnose other serious health problems. And the tricorder, the inventor hopes, will also be used in the future to test for infectious diseases.
And the second device, how does it work?
I love the second invention because it's worn like a piece of jewelry on your finger. It's a flexible ring that's embedded with a wireless echocardiogram sensor that can diagnose heart irregularities as well as other conditions. And like the tricorder, the results can be delivered to a phone app anywhere, such as your home or to your doctor. What's great about both these devices, Susan, is that the patient can actually use these in their own home. They don't need somebody there to help them do this. So they can monitor their own health, and they can also get the results very quickly to make some decisions on their own health.
Well, when might these be available?
Well, the hope is that these diagnostic tools will be in the hands of doctors and patients within just a few years. And if that happens, it'll be interesting to see what people think about using them, because there are some people who don't like putting sensors on their bodies, which is understandable. It's something we're not used to. But for people who have chronic conditions, you know, who are at risk of, you know, as we mentioned, a heart attack or some other serious problem, these devices could be useful and life-saving. They also, besides cutting the time of the results, they might cut costs because there's not a full-size laboratory involved. And, of course, hopefully save a lot of lives.
And also, privacy is an issue. People using this in their own home could maintain their privacy.
That's absolutely right. They sure could.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Nike's laceless athletic shoes with the awkward name HyperAdapt 1.0. Nike says the new shoe is powered by an underfoot lacing mechanism. Think tiny motor that runs on a battery that needs charging every couple of weeks. When your heel hits a sensor in the bottom of the shoe, the laces tighten. You manually control the fit by pressing a plus or minus button on the top of the shoe. Nike claims the shoe will provide precise, consistent, personalized lockdown for the wearer, adding that the fit can be manually adjusted on the go. The new shoes won't be available until later this year, and the company says the HyperAdapt 1.0 will be sold only to members of the company's Nike Plus app service, which gets decidedly mixed reviews. Just Google it. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
A pioneer of hip-hop, lyricist Fife Dawg of A Tribe Called Quest has died. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about his contributions.
Yeah, it is a tragedy, and he was a master lyricist, and he was sort of the fun one of A Tribe Called Quest. The Tribe, of course, Q-Tip, Ali Shaheed Muhammad, and Fife Dawg, and he'll say something, and you're like, oh, I can't believe he just said that. Did he really just say that? That was so funny. That was so clever. He was a clever guy, but unfortunately, he was suffering from type 1 diabetes, and it was well known, and we got to see this in 2001. There was a movie called Beats, Rhymes, and Life, about Tribe Called Quest. And we got to see in that movie that although he was aware that he had diabetes and that he was supposed to take care of himself in a certain way, he, you know, he enjoyed life. And unfortunately, that included some foods and things that one with diabetes shouldn't. A lot of sugar, things like that. So he was ill during the filming of the movie, and he had to have a kidney replaced, I believe, and it was kind of, unfortunately, downhill from there as far as his health was concerned.
Now, what would you say was his main contribution to hip-hop from Quest and, you know, from his lyrics? Did other people, because there's other Machine Gun lyricists, Eminem comes to my mind, but they pull things and you have to sit down with a piece of paper and read the lyrics and go, wait a minute, did he really? Is that because of Fife? Was he like a pioneer in that way?
Well, I don't know that I would consider Fife to be a Machine Gun lyricist necessarily. I mean, he didn't have that really super fast delivery. He was clever. You know, when I think of a Kanye West, for example, I'm like, okay, Kanye obviously, and I'm talking about early Kanye West here, obviously was influenced by Fife Dawg, because Fife, again, would put things, I mean, he called himself the 5-foot assassin. And I mean, there are lyrics, I don't know that I can repeat them here on the air, but because some of them were, you know, a little risque.
Right.
But again, just to hear these things come out of his mouth, they you would stop. You would think to yourself, number one, he is such a lyricist. He really has this interesting command of the English language. And number two, he does it kind of in jest. Like he didn't take himself very seriously. At least it didn't appear that he did lyrically. I'm sure as a lyricist, we know as a lyricist, as a hip hop artist, he took himself seriously. And Tribe Called Quest, they provided the soundtrack for a generation. If you were coming up in the early 90s or the mid 90s and you were a hip hop fan, even if you were a pop music fan, because they began to kind of move into that arena as well, you were familiar with at least one song. You had at least heard Bonita Applebum if you had heard nothing else. And with Fife and then Q-Tip's production, because Q-Tip is a phenomenal producer, and he would always take these really sort of eccentric, kind of off-the-wall samples and create masterpieces out of them. That is the contribution, I think, that Fife and then the group Tribe Called Quest made to hip-hop.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 24th each year, nations around the globe observe World Tuberculosis Day, commemorating Dr. Robert Koch's 1882 discovery of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacteria that caused the disease. The observance is designed to build public awareness about the global epidemic of tuberculosis. Tuberculosis, or TB, is the second leading cause of death from infectious diseases worldwide, infecting almost 9 million people and killing some 1.5 million. Prior to the advent of antibiotics in the 1940s, TB was one of the most feared diseases around. Today, the majority of TB deaths occur in the developing world, where the disease is closely linked to poverty, marginalized and vulnerable populations, substandard housing, and poor nutrition. This year's theme, 2016, Unite to End TB, aims to advance the United Nations goal of ending the epidemic by the year 2030. The idea is to promote collaboration and communication among various concerned groups and individuals across sectors and disciplines of every sort, so they can exchange ideas and utilize their expertise to eliminate some of the obstacles that need to be overcome if we are to succeed. This means that, as part of the campaign to vanquish TB, we must do our best to eliminate poverty, which helps sustain the epidemic. We must find better, more efficient ways to test for the disease and to treat and cure those who are found to suffer from it. We must find a way to end the stigmatization of the victims of tuberculosis and end discriminatory practices against them. And we must find new ways to attack the disease and its attendant problems. The United States is committed to fighting tuberculosis. In focusing our efforts in countries where the burden of TB is highest, we support programs that save lives and foster a more secure world. Across the federal government, we have made this fight a priority. We continue to partner with the World Health Organization, or WHO, the Stop TB Partnership, and the Global Drug Facility to provide important support for TB control activities worldwide and achieve the world's vision with the adoption of the Sustainable Development Goals. By joining in a global commitment to stop the spread of TB, we can begin to free a new generation from an ancient affliction.